Well, good evening, and delighted to welcome you here for what we hope will be a termly talk by a visiting speaker here, probably at various different times of terms to keep all parties happy, but a really nice one to start us off. I'll do the plug for Ian. This small tome, I think, is one of the most important books I've read in many years. And it's especially good to hear it spoken about here, because those of us of a certain age who remember the founder of this society, Dr. Francis Rolls, may remember in, I think, the late 70s, him getting very excited about the research of Roger Sperry in the States, realizing that the different hemispheres of the brain perform different functions, and how we tend to get trapped in what for most right-handed people is the left hemisphere, which goes very narrow and looks after our language and does all sorts of things that Ian will describe much better than I. But that, in the 70s, I think you'll probably agree, was very much the Ladybird book end of it. There's been so much work on that since, a lot of it by Ian. In fact, way back, probably around then, he was intending to read theology and philosophy at Oxford, but I'm not quite sure how it happened, but you ended up reading English literature. But being a Renaissance man, that wasn't enough, and he proceeded to do a medical training as well and be highly successful as a consultant psychiatrist at the Maudsley, neuroimaging researcher at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and so on. And I think for a lot of that time, this book has been slowly gestating. I think it's taken, am I right, about 20 years to write. So we're very, very privileged to get the executive summary of that tonight. And I think it takes it a lot further than what we were hearing through Dr. Rolls back in the 70s, because it explains not only that we have these two halves of the brain, but it also rather goes to explain the Western predicament and most of Western philosophy along the way, which is a modest achievement. So I'm very pleased to welcome Ian McGilchrist.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you. Thank you, and can you hear me? Is that working? Yes, I think it is, yeah. Also, I'm grateful to you for varying the night on which you meet in order to fit in for me. That's very kind. I'm not going to try to, as Martin said, summarize this book. There was a Monty Python sketch about summarizing Proust. I'm not going to try and do that, actually. There are some little leaflets there on the table which are just really flyers which were created early on. The book came out 6 months ago, a little bit over now, 9 months ago, published by Yale University Press, and they produced some flyers at the time. But actually the best way to get it is just to Google my name, and it will give you Amazon and it will give you all the deals and so on. So that's the book anyway. And what I'm going to do is say a little bit about how it came about, one or two of the themes in it, and some of the things I would like you to take away to think about, and then perhaps you can ask me questions. So I suppose the best place to start, is there a clock in this room, or no? Well, in this gloaming, I won't know how I'm doing, but I'll try. Anyway, so when you all fall, last person to fall asleep, you know, give me a psych signal. Yes, I mean, as Martin said, I've had a bit of a checkered career, and that is relevant to the story of this book. When I was doing English literature at Oxford and trying to teach it, I became aware increasingly of a problem inherent in the whole process of looking at works of art in the way that one would have to do in the academy. And this was partly to do with the old problem of dissecting something, but it was more really about the nature of the work of art as an embodied entity, which existed only in the incarnate form in which it was, and which acted on us as incarnate beings, and that by discarnating it and abstracting from it ideas and forms and so forth, one was left really at the end of the day with a handful of dust, because the thing you went to it for in the first place was the absolutely unique thisness of the thing. Hardy's poems are perhaps a particularly good example, because they're so wonderful and they're so special, and if Hardy hadn't existed, we wouldn't have any way of having thought of them. But if you actually start taking them apart, they're full of all sorts of imperfections, really, and problems. And perhaps there's nothing very interesting to say about his thought. And yet, he's one of the great poets of the English language, so there's definitely a problem there. And that got me thinking about the so-called mind-body problem, and so I read philosophy and psychology people about that, but I found that they were a bit too disembodied in their thinking about it, so that the whole problem became an intellectual problem, and it seemed to me that one needed more to live it, really. And with that in mind, I went off to study medicine, because I was very struck by Oliver Sacks' book, Awakenings, when it first came out. I gather there's been a film. I can't imagine how there could be a film of this book, because so much of it is in the footnotes. But if you have only seen the film, then do read the book. It took him 13 years to write, and is definitely his greatest work. And most of the rest of the stuff he's written since has been pretty much journalism. But that is a great book, in which he pays great attention to individuals and has some very profound things, I think, to say about the relationship between mind and body. So I thought, if I want to know more about this, I ought to go off and study medicine and become somewhere in the borderlines of neurology and psychiatry, which is what I did. I did medicine, I did some neurology, and I ended up in psychiatry, and that's what I now do. There was also a little aside to this. I wrote a book called Against Criticism in the 1980s, published by Faber, which was really about the problems in criticizing literature. Not particularly in the various isms that dominated things in those days, Marxism, structuralism, and so forth, although I didn't feel that they did justice to the unique qualities of the work of art, but instead took one away to somewhere else to think about a body of ideas one could have contemplated irrelevantly, as it were, to the works in hand. But because I thought there was something inherently problematic about bringing our brains to bear in this focused way on a work of art. And partly this was to do with the fact that the things that were important needed to be implicit. And once they were made explicit, they changed their nature. It just wasn't the same thing once you'd taken them out of context and brought them into the focus of attention. And I was talking over lunch to a sinologist who was also a fellow of All Souls, which is the college that generously housed me for a number of years. And this was a lovely man called David Hawkes, sadly now dead. And I was explaining to him what I was writing about. And I was saying, the trouble is, it's very difficult to find the words in which to express it, because every time I use words, they bring me back to a way of thinking which is exactly the kind of thinking I'm trying to transcend. And he said, well, the Chinese would have no difficulty in understanding what you're talking about, and he directed me to some reading which I found very interesting, entirely in an amateur way. So there I was doing medicine, and I was a registrar in psychiatry at the Maudsley, a big teaching hospital in London, and one day there was going to be a lecture by a colleague called John Cutting. He is a remarkable man who wrote a book which is still a classic, published by OUP in 1990, called The Right Cerebral Hemisphere and Psychiatric Disorders. And I went to hear what he had to say, because in medical school I had heard very little about the right hemisphere. I'd heard a lot about all the clever and special things that the left hemisphere did. It could reason, it had language, it was the one that did the heavy lifting. But somehow this right hemisphere, well, God knows really what it did. And it might have done something pink and fluffy. to do with creativity or something. That was the sort of idea. And that, of course, was very much the idea in the pop culture, which has since gone into advertising and marketing. And, you know, the left hemisphere is, you know, right but repulsive, as I say in the book. The left hemisphere is right and repulsive. The right hemisphere, wrong but romantic. But it's not really like that at all. And I began to realize how unlike that it was when I listened to John talking. Because what he explained was that many of the things that seemed to me so important and that had seemed to me the problems in the study of literature were to do with a way of taking in experience mediated by the right hemisphere. For example, he explained that the right hemisphere understood implicit meaning, it understood indirect meaning, it understood metaphor, it understood body language, it understood 9/10, in fact, of what it is that we communicate when we talk. It seemed to be more in touch with the body. It seemed, therefore, to be more concerned with the embodied nature of things, with the uniqueness of unique instances of things, rather than with the categories into which they fitted. It was more interested in sense of humour and in tone. It was more aware of these things and more aware of the general context in which anything lay. So it saw things only in relation to all the other things, not just as an atomistic thing on its own. And all this seemed to me very striking indeed. And I talked to John after the lecture. I was very excited. And I gave him a copy of my book, my early book, the one about literature, which he read with some enthusiasm, dear man that he is, and we got together and did some research on psychosis and the hemispheres, and then I went to Johns Hopkins and did some neuroimaging work on the brains of schizophrenic individuals and asymmetries in them, which was becoming a very relevant issue for me. It turns out the schizophrenics have a loss of the normal asymmetry in the brain, and I'll have more to say about asymmetry in the brain shortly. So that's a bit of a preamble, really, about me and how I got to write this book. But I began to think more and more about what was going on in the world around me, and it was a little bit helped by the fact that I was in Baltimore. It was not my first visit to America, but it was the first time I'd lived in America for any length of time. And I became aware of something rather striking. America is, of course, the future for all of us. And when I looked at it, I was a bit amazed, really, to see in 1992 how explicit everything had to be. It might have been something to do with the future, or it might have been something to do with just being in America. But I found that I wasn't understood. My tone of voice wasn't understood. The implicit meaning, which was sometimes contrary to what I was saying, wasn't understood. And altogether, I was talking at cross purposes. But it wasn't just a language problem, it was also in the culture. So that I discovered that at the university, the undergraduates were issued with a handbook in which they were told how to date members of the opposite sex. Well, you know, I understand the very well-meaning intentions out of which this came, and I respect them, but it does seem to me that when one has to consult a handbook to learn how to date somebody, it's all up, really. The implicit has become grossly explicit, and we might as well pack it in. So, on a more serious note, that did seem to me an aspect of our culture in general, and my God, has it been borne out in the last 18 years since I was there. Now there is a code of practice for everything. There is a set of guidelines. There is an algorithm. There are ways in which things must be done and rules that must be followed for just about everything. And we can no longer trust intuition, implicitness, and the things that we used to take for granted. So it became a question with me, what's happened in the modern world? And there's another very interesting book I can mention by a chap called Louis Sass, not Thomas Zaz, the rather irritating 60s and 70s anti-psychiatry man, but a much more intelligent man called Louis Sass, a psychologist at Rutgers, who wrote a fascinating book called Madness and Modernism, subtitled Insanity in the Light of Modern Art, Literature and Thought. And what that was about was the fact that he had looked in considerable detail at the phenomena of modernism in all its variations in art, in theatre, in poetry, in music, and so forth, and likened it to how the world appears to the schizophrenic mind. And it was very, very striking, and still is a very subtle and compelling book. The thing that really struck me about it was that I was learning more and more that the schizophrenic mind is like the mind of somebody whose right hemisphere is not really working properly. They don't understand implicit meaning. They take it literally. They haven't got empathy. They don't seem to be able to think about things in an implicit way. Everything that would normally be taken for granted has to be teased through theoretically and explicitly. And indeed, Leary characterizes schizophrenia as not an absence of reason, as madness has always been thought to be, but a hyper-acute, hyper-reflexive, hyper-aware state in which reason has become over-rational. So it struck me that perhaps if he was saying there was a lot that was in the modern world that was rather like the mind of the schizophrenic, what he might be saying was there was a lot in the modern world that was rather like what we'd be left with if we were working on our left hemispheres alone. And that really became the topic of this book. So this book is in fact divided into two parts. And in the first part, I look at the vast body of research that has grown up on differences between the hemispheres. Often this is not, again, the focus of the research. It may be on something else because it's no longer fashionable, it's no longer indeed respectable for a neuroscientist to talk about hemisphere differences because they're also frightened by the awful popular caricatures. And of course it has become clear that none of all that stuff is true. So often you have to look in these papers for the information. But if you do, and just actually look at these papers and see what they do tell you about the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, there is a vast mass of information that we now have. And I deal with that in this book. There are about 2,500 papers referenced here. So I'm prepared to be challenged on any of it by anybody. Nobody so far has. So in the first part of the book, I look at that, and I look at the philosophical implications of it, because it seems to me that it does have philosophical implications. I will try to unpack a little as we go along. The second half of the book is really a rather absurd undertaking, which is a sort of very rapid tour through the history of Western civilization from the ancient world through the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, Romanticism, modernism and postmodernism, and bringing us up to the present day. But looking at it from what I believe we learn in the first part of the book about the differences between the two hemispheres. And today I'm going to talk mainly about the first part and then leap to the end of the book. So when I started to look at this literature, the first thing I noticed was why people had given up trying to speculate about what hemisphere differences was. In the old days, language and reason were in the left hemisphere, pictures and emotions in the right. But it turns out that language is subserved by both hemispheres. Reason is subserved by both hemispheres. In fact, mathematics probably primarily goes on in the right hemisphere, not the left. Emotions, both hemispheres have them. Pictures and images dealt with equally by both hemispheres. So it looks like a bit of a dead end. Or does it? Because it struck me that it's not about what the brain does as though it's a machine, it's about how it does it. So yes, each part of the brain looks at all these things, images and words and reason and so forth, but it has its own particular take on it. And I began to think, so what is going on here? We've got sort of two hemispheres of a brain taking a different look at the world that we inhabit. And I began to think more about the structure of the brain, and I asked myself the simple question, which I don't remember anybody really asking, and I'm not aware of anyone answering, is why is the brain divided at all? Let me just show you a picture. That is the brain. A very simple sketch of the brain looked at from above. That's the front of the brain at the top and the back at the bottom. The right hemisphere has been pushed aside to show this connecting band of tissues called the corpus callosum, which in the old days nobody knew what it did. They used to think it was perhaps a bolster that stopped the brain from sagging. But it turns out it's composed of somewhere near a billion fibres, 800 million probably fibres, connecting the brain, but in fact only connecting 2% of the neurons in the brain. And the plot thickens when you discover that you work out what those neurons do, you discover that mainly their job is inhibitory. It does transfer information, but the purpose of the information is largely to say, wait a moment, keep out of this on your side, I'm dealing with this. So that sounds intriguing. And it's particularly remarkable when you think that consciousness, that great thing that we think marks out human beings from the rest of creation, is supposed to come from the interconnectedness, the sheer interconnectedness, so neuroscientists say, of neurons. Well, if it's going to come from the sheer interconnectedness of neurons, and that's really what the brain is all about, and there are an estimated infinite, pretty much, number of connections in the brain, more than there are actually particles in the known universe, what the hell is going on with this big divide? It turns out that human beings' brains are more divided than those lower down the phylogenetic tree. So this demarcation of the hemispheres has got more rather than less marked through evolution. If it had been important to unify, it could have gone the other way. That raises, of course, the question that it's not just us that have two hemispheres. So do most animals, reptiles, birds. And so what do we know about that? Well, there's quite a bit of literature about it, actually, and it's pretty interesting. And I think probably the simplest way to convey what the difference is to give you the illustration of a chicken trying to solve the problem of how to eat and stay alive at the same time. Because if you think about it, it's got a difficult task. It's got to actually identify that little seed against the background of gravel on which it lies. So it's got to have very sharply focused attention to a detail, but it's also got to keep a very wide open attention for predators, otherwise it won't have finished the meal. So chickens solve this, and indeed all animals, it turns out, have this difference, that one of their hemispheres pays a very close, detailed attention to something that it already knows it is interested in, usually prey or food, whereas the right hemisphere keeps a wide open attention for whatever might be without preconception, because it's got to look out for, is it a foe, is it a friend, is it a predator, is it my mate, what is it that might else be going on in this world while I'm focusing on this detail. In chickens, it's pretty straightforward because they have eyes on the sides of their heads, not like us on the front of the head. So, in fact, the right eye simply goes to the left hemisphere and the left eye goes to the right hemisphere. It's not quite as simple in human beings. It's the left visual field goes to the right hemisphere and the right visual field goes to the left hemisphere in human beings, but it's a variation on the same condition. And it turns out that, in fact, most animals tend to prefer to approach their conspecifics and to engage in mating rituals with the opposite sex, using their right hemisphere and their left eye. They will tend to latch on to prey with their right foot and with their right eye visually guiding it from their left hemisphere. So there seems to be a basic sort of thing going on there. The left hemisphere is about grasping something that I already know I'm interested in. And the left... Sorry, did I say the right hemisphere? I mean the left hemisphere. And the right hemisphere is about an uncommitted, open attention to the rest of the context in which we live, whatever it might be, including our fellow beings. So one is rather individualistic and atomistic, the other more already... consensual or common in its focus. And it turns out that animals that are not properly naturalised have disadvantages. They don't actually survive so well. So clearly it has meaning in terms of survival. Now, what happens when you come to human beings? Well, as you might imagine, the first thing to say is that attention is like this in human beings. We know from people who've had strokes in the right or left hemisphere or other injuries that generally speaking, what happens when you impair the right hemisphere is there's a loss of vigilance and there's a loss of broad attention and a loss of sustained attention. If you have damage to the left hemisphere, it seems to be there's more of a damage, more of a loss of focused attention and detailed attention. And so that seems to be also true in human beings. And that might sound a little bit dull. And cognitive scientists often talk about attention as though it's just another function, you know, like all these other functions the brain does. Like, you know, sort of apparently it has memory function and it has emotional function, and I don't know. But anyway, attention is something quite different, because attention is something a machine cannot do anyway. A machine can't attend to something. It can process something, but attention, for attention you have to have consciousness. And it is interesting, because if you believe, as I do, that there is no such thing either as the world just existing out there, and it's our job, just like photographic plates, to take it in and process it like a computer and understand it, nor is it true that the world is somehow just conceived by our minds and there's nothing out there, if it's neither of those two, it must be something that comes about through the coming together of ourselves with whatever it is apart from ourselves that exists. And what's very clear is the kind of attention you pay to the world changes the kind of world that you find. It's not just that the kind of thing you're going to pay attention to governs the nature of the appropriate attention to pay to it. Clearly that is the case. You pay a different attention to your loved one from the attention you pay to your patient or whatever. But it's also true that the kind of attention you pay influences what it is that actually exists out there for you to come into contact with. So it's a very remarkable reciprocal process. At least that's my philosophical take. Now, if that's the case, then the kind of attention matters a lot. If you think of a mountain, for example, a mountain can be many things. It can be a source of mineral wealth to a prospector. It can be a landmark to a navigator. It can be a wonderful textured surface to a painter. It can be the home of the gods to people who have anciently lived there. And how you see it changes what it is that you think a mountain actually is. And the scientific description of it is not more real in some sense than any of those. It's just an alternative description which privileges disengagement from the world. But there's no reason why we should necessarily privilege disengagement from the world. All our lives are about engaging with the world. And although disengagement tells us something, I wouldn't deny that at all. It's a very important thing to be able to do. It's also very important to bring that knowledge to bear when you engage with the world. So there's this, both things have to be happening. We have to be engaging with the world, and we have to be disengaging. We have to be showing broad attention, we have to be showing focused attention. And I think that the two hemispheres enable us to do this. Now, I'm just going to go back to that slide, because it's just to show you one thing. This is the neural tube of the human fetus at 33 days gestation. And I really only put it on to show you that lower down in that tadpole-like creature, you've got the bits that are going to turn into the brainstem and so forth. And they are they're just sort of separating out. They're just getting broader. So if you wanted a bit more space, you could just broaden like that. You don't have to actually separate. But in fact, as you go up, you see that the bit at the top, the Mickey Mouse ears, those are going to turn into the cerebral cortex. They're going to lift up and become the two cerebral hemispheres. And already, it's not just a broadening, it's a distinct budding off of two things that are going to remain distinct. So that is in itself intriguing. This is a very simple picture of the brain viewed from the side. That's the front on the left and the back on the right and the cerebellum underneath. And all I'm putting this up for you to see at the moment is that line about halfway across the brain going downwards, which is labelled the Rolandic fissure. That is the posterior limit of the frontal cortex. In other words, the frontal lobes are all that bit of the brain in front of that. That interests a lot of people who haven't spent a lot of time looking at the brain, because they think possibly they've heard of the frontal lobes. They probably think it's a little bit of brain behind their forehead sort of thing. But actually, it's an enormous part of the brain. It's 35% of the whole mass of the human brain. And even a relatively intelligent animal like a dog, the frontal lobes are only about 7%. And in the lower primates, about 17%. In the great apes, it gets near to being the same as the human brain, actually, which is pretty interesting. The thing that differentiates it is that we have more white matter in ours, which I could talk about if you wanted. But anyway, the point I want to make is that there's something very important that happens in humans, which is we get frontal lobes enormously expanded. Now, what do frontal lobes do? Frontal lobes are mainly about inhibition, which is interesting because we've already been talking about how important it is for bits of the brain to inhibit one another. And in fact, most of what it does is it stops you from doing things you would otherwise have done. It stops you from taking the immediate point of view. It enables you to stand back a bit and sort of have a think about other possibilities. So it enables you to plan. It enables you to think ahead into the future. It enables you to develop a strategy. If it goes like this, I'll do that. If it goes like this, I'll do that. It enables you to think what another fellow creature might have in his or her mind, not just what's going on in your mind. So it's very important for organizing, for projecting, for planning, for controlling one's immediate instincts to do X now because it seems like the thing I'd like to do now, and says, no, let's not do that now for a greater gain in the future. So that's what the frontal lobes enable us to do, in brief. They put a distance, a temporal distance and a spatial distance between us and the world. Now, distance is not the same as detachment. Distance is very important sometimes for connecting. For example, if I have a book and I hold it here, I can't read it. If I hold it too far away, I can't read it either. There has to be the right distance, what I call necessary distance. And that's also true of ourselves. Too close to reality, we don't see it. We can't stand back and get the picture overall. Too far away, and we do feel detached. But there is a proper distance in which we can actually understand something, like understanding a painting, understanding another human individual. And so it's often said about the frontal lobes, neuroscientists are very fond of talking about the Machiavellian brain, because of course, you know, we're all mean, really, deep down. The truth is, we're all vicious and mean and in constant competition with one another. But I say no. Yes, the frontal lobe does enable you to do that, principally on the left side, actually. But the right frontal lobe is all about the generation of empathy. And empathy is something that only comes about when you're able to stand back a little bit enough from the immediacy of experience and think, that person probably feels some of the things I feel. And that causes a bond. So as well as being the Machiavellian brain, the frontal lobes mediate what I call the Erasmian brain, in which we feel more tolerantly, empathically connected. So the brain's got to do two rather different things in a very human sense now. It's got to be able to be detached and scheming and have a plan, and it's got to be able to go out and meet the world and have empathy with people and with the other things that exist in the world. And one way you might like to think of this is that the brain does need to have a sort of map, really, of a kind, a very simplified version of the world which works for our purposes. Think about a general planning a campaign. He could go out and meet every one of the soldiers and have a look at the terrain and so on. He might want to do a little bit of that. But basically, if he's going to know what he's doing, he's got to be back at HQ with a map on the wall, which doesn't show all the awful realities of what's going on, but has it all cleaned up, neatly organized, and a few flags so he can, you know, push them around. So we need to be able, if we're going to be able to use the world and manipulate it, we need to be able to stand back from the world and have a very simplified version that works for utility, for manipulation, for use of the world. But we also need not to lose sight of what we learn if we actually go out into the world along the what I call the horizontal axis rather than the vertical axis, and actually meet the world and meet people that are engaged with it. And to when you go and look at the rest of the neuropsychological literature about what differentiates the brain, a whole lot of things follow, really, almost entirely from this difference in the nature of attention. In the left hemisphere, you have the world represented. Represented is an interesting word because it suggests that it's not immediately present. It's present again in a new form. And what actually presence is to us, which is a word we don't have in the English language except in translations of Heidegger, but I mean, that was what Heidegger was getting at, is that there is a thing in which the world actually becomes present to us in all its awesomeness, and that we lose sight of the extraordinary nature of just being and the fact that there is anything at all. Now, that sort of immediacy of take on the world is more present to the right hemisphere, the precognitive take. And almost immediately for us as adults, which is what Wordsworth lamented about the growing mind, is it gets represented. We've no sooner seen a beautiful landscape than automatically it's become a picturesque scene that is related to 1,000 paintings we've already seen, and so forth. So everything becomes a representation of itself very, very quickly in the left hemisphere and is categorized so that we can use that information helpfully. And as you go on, I'm not going to bother too much about this, you find there are a whole lot of areas of difference. This is a bit odd. It's doing something rather strange, but I'll let it do it anyway. Oops, back. Right, we don't have to try and digest this whole list, but essentially these are some of the areas of difference between the two hemispheres. On the one hand, you've got the right hemisphere having this broad perspective, and the left hemisphere grasping. And it's not by accident that it controls the right hand with which we grasp things, and those aspects of language, not language as a whole, but those aspects of language with which we pin things down. It's also the right hemisphere that is aware of the new things as they present, whereas the represented reality is what the left hemisphere gets to know. And you can only know something if it's relatively stable and fixed. And I suppose one of the ways I could characterize the difference between the two worlds of the hemispheres is that the left hemisphere presents us pieces of knowledge that are minute but certain in their own way. And it was Hegel who pointed out, by the way, that certainty has an inverse relationship to content. It's a little bit like, I always think, a version of Heidegger's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that you know you can't specify both the position and the momentum of a particle at the same time. If you try to pin something down and make it totally fixed, you lose a lot of its content. And so one of them has the known little bits of information that it puts together that are static, fixed, certain, isolated, disconnected, both from the observer and from the rest of experience. Whereas the right hemisphere doesn't have the advantage of knowing simple, easy, fixed things. It sees everything as interconnected and as partaking of everything else that exists. So it sees a continuously flowing a flux, a continuum of things that are always changing, never final, never certain, always becoming, and to which we are profoundly related and which are related one to another. And this affects all these other things. So, you know, one of them, as I say, shows what is possible, the other the predictable. The hierarchy of attention is just about this little interesting slide. I imagine most people here see an H and a 4. Yeah? Some people will see a lot of E's and a lot of 8's. But the norm for most people is to see the big picture first, using their right hemisphere. It doesn't mean you've got schizophrenia if you see E's and 8's mainly, but it is actually interestingly true that people with schizophrenia do tend to see that and miss what's going on in the broad picture. So the whole is what the right hemisphere sees. The parts that don't go to make up that whole, as it turns out, are what the left hemisphere sees. The right hemisphere sees things in context, the left abstractedly. The right has the sense of the unique, the left of the category. And so forth. One quite interesting one is the living and non-living. It's a very remarkable and repeated finding. Many studies have shown this, that machines and tools are a particular predilection of the left hemisphere, and that the right hemisphere tends not to deal with them. It tends to deal with the animate. The left hemisphere also deals with the animate, particularly when it's an object of interest or prey or manipulation. But there is, at least in one study, there was an absolutely clean difference between the left and right, the left dealing with the inanimate and the right with the animate. Empathy, the theory of mind and emotions, are going to take us too long, so I'm going to have to sort of bypass that really, except to say that broadly speaking, those emotions that connect us to other people tend to be right hemisphere mediated, which is why it has a reputation for dealing with the so-called negative, i.e. sadness. And of course the language is very loaded by the left hemisphere, which makes up these terms. It doesn't seem to be that anything at all negative about sadness. In fact, not to have the capacity to be sad would be to be a psychopath, really. And in fact there is evidence that in children that don't have a capacity for sadness, they tend to be conduct disordered and tend to go on to become psychopathic as adults. So there is a relationship there. Reason versus rationality. I just need to gloss that a little. I think it's a distinction I refer to constantly in the book, that reason is not the same thing as rationality. As I said about Sass and the schizophrenic mind, there is such a thing as a kind of hyper-rationality, which is in itself totally unreasonable. To start going through algorithms to solve every everyday problem would be a completely unreasonable thing to do. And reason takes into account our intuitions, not just any old intuition, but our educated, groomed intuitions over a lifetime of experience, with balancing them with what we can reason about and so forth. And used to be the summit of human achievement, the Renaissance, judgment, as it was called, and the capacity to reason were thought to be the highest things that humans could achieve, and they didn't mean acting like computers. The twin bodies, the two hemispheres see the body differently. The left sees a mass of pieces and parts, as if it were a machine that was put together. The right hemisphere sees the body as a whole and has the whole body image. And I'm not going to deal with the other ones, meaning and time, music and time, very, very interesting, and so forth. I may refer to them very briefly, but they would just honestly take us too long. But they are relevant here. Now, I'm just going to go back for a moment to, if I can, to this slide, because it just is rather interesting, and it got me thinking about another aspect of this. This is a synthesis of a lot of computer tomography pictures of the brain. And what you're looking at here needs a little moment of orientation. You're looking at the brain from below, as though you were in your own spinal cord and looking up at the base of the brain, right? So that's not the top of the brain, that's the bottom of the brain, with the front at the top and the back at the bottom, right? So just to make things easy, the right hemisphere is on the left and the left hemisphere is on the right. And if you look at that picture, you'll see the thing I was told about in medical school, which was that the big thing that the left hemisphere did was language. And it is true that it does play an important part in language. It has a lot of the vocabulary and most of the complex syntax, it's quite true, although the right hemisphere has a pretty extensive vocabulary, particularly if the left hemisphere is switched off for any good reason for a while, the right hemisphere comes into its own. But actually, the ultimate meaning of what we say is interpreted by the right hemisphere. If I say, it's a bit hot in here today, the right hemisphere understands immediately that what I mean is, would you please open a window? But the left hemisphere thinks I'm just supplying helpful meteorological data. So the thing was that the left hemisphere has language, and because there's a very, very big lexicon, most people in this room will have a vocabulary of about 70,000 words, and the average chimpanzee has none, but the most educated ever chimpanzee in language spoke 130. So that is a big human difference, it's true. But I'm going to just get up onto the platform for a moment. This is the left hemisphere, remember. Now, this bit here is clearly broader than on the other side. Can you see that? And that is the receptive language area of the left hemisphere. And the reasoning was, it's bigger because language is a big thing, and humans have got it, and it's better be all kept in one place, worked better that way. It had to be somewhere, so it just ended up in the left hemisphere. And there are a whole lot of reasons why that can't be a satisfactory explanation. The first is that it isn't all kept in one place, as I've just explained. Both hemispheres deal with language, so that's not the answer. Also, if you scan orangutans and gorillas and the great apes, you find they've got one of these bumps too, and they don't do talking. So that can't be right. And if you look at the skulls of prehistoric man in the pre-linguistic phase of his development, you'll find that this, if you look at the impress in the skull, of the fossilized skull, you'll see that also the brain was distended slightly in this area posteriorly in the left hemisphere. But there's another good reason why this can't be the only explanation, because it's not the only bump. In fact, the biggest bump in the brain, the biggest asymmetry of all, the most staggeringly obvious difference in this brain, is that the right hemisphere, in the frontal lobe, is much broader than the left. Can you see that? It goes further forward slightly, it's broader, and it slightly overlaps. Whereas at the left, it does the opposite. It's broadened, it goes backward, and it slightly overlaps. And it's as though somebody had got hold of the brain and tweaked it in the direction of the arrows, which is why that's called Yakovlevian talk. Well, that's not why it's called Yakovlevian talk. It's called Yakovlevian talk because Yakovlev described it, but that's what it is. And it got me thinking, you know, well, what the hell's going on here? Because if you just want more brain capacity, you wouldn't do it asymmetrically. You'd only do that if it was quite clear that nature, again, was trying to keep some things separate from other things. And the conclusion I've come to is that it's very important for each part of the hemisphere to be doing its own job uninterrupted by the other. It can't know what the other one knows. If it did, it would stop doing the job. And that's where the metaphor that is the title of my book, The Master and His Emissary, comes in. This is based very loosely on a story in Nietzsche, and I think sometimes I dreamt it. And it's about a wise spiritual master who had a small community that he governed wisely, and it flourished as a result. And eventually he realized he couldn't deal with all the concerns of the community. So he needed to deputize, and he needed to deputize to somebody who was very good, very intelligent, and very trusted, who could do his work on his behalf. But he realized it wasn't just a failure of capacity that he couldn't do this, i.e. one person couldn't do it. It was also important that he didn't get involved in certain things, because if he did, he couldn't maintain some of his other ways of seeing and being. And the story is that this emissary went off and did all this work on the master's behalf, and after a while he realized that he was the one that was really the bright one here, who was doing all the hard work in this little empire, and that in fact the master was probably an irrelevant sitting back there at home twiddling his hands. And so he abrogated the cloak of his master, and as a result the community disintegrated. And to me, this is the story of what happens here in the brain. There's a lot of rather wonderful evidence that the right hemisphere grounds our experience. It's the first to take in whatever there might be. If you think just about the breadth of its focus, it's likely to be the case. New experience comes from the edges, and so it's going to be the first one to take it in, even in that literal sense. But most of what we get is, as I say, precognitively more alive in the right hemisphere. And then it's processed by the left hemisphere. That's a necessary stage. It tells us important things. Without it, we couldn't have had civilization. We couldn't have built wonderful temples and houses. We couldn't have had proper drainage and hygiene. We couldn't have medicine. We couldn't have many of the things. So that part of our brain needs to be working. Let me make that very clear. But it's not the whole picture. It's not at all the whole picture. And what that bit of information reveals needs to be taken back to what the right hemisphere knows and reintegrated into the whole picture. Then it works. So there's a sort of movement from right to left and back to right again. But what seems to be happening, a la the master and his emissary, is the emissary is sent off to do his work, and then he doesn't play ball. He goes, right, I'm the one up. It's my little world now, and this is what it looks like. It's very simple, actually. I understand all the workings of it. It's, in fact, the story of the sorcerer's apprentice, isn't it? Goethe's poem, which was set to music by, turned into a musical poem by Dukas. So we all know about the dangers of hubris. In fact, that is the subject of classical tragedy. and we might now be becoming the subjects of classical tragedy. And I just want to say a little bit, we don't need to go to all that again. Oh, that's just a, people have seen this kind of thing before, have you? If you have a, mustn't get distracted. I mean, if you have a right hemisphere stroke, you lose the left half of space. Those pictures are being copied by somebody with a right hemisphere problem on the right, and just the left half of reality goes away. People standing on the left are not noticed. They will only read the right-hand page of a newspaper, sometimes only the right-hand half of the right-hand page, may only dress the right-hand side of the body. This is because the left hemisphere is not interested in providing anything other than the right half of reality, the bit that it's grasping and focused on. It's the right hemisphere that gives the whole picture, and when the right hemisphere goes on the blink, you lose the bit that only the right hemisphere is responsible for. This is a nice one. Anybody who's a psychologist will probably recognize this. Just out of interest, how many people have seen this picture before? Okay. Is anybody puzzled about what it shows? Okay. It's a spotted dog. I don't know if you can see it. Again, I could point this out. Its nose is there. Its ear is hanging down there. Its back is over there. Hind leg, front leg, shade of a tree, paths crossing. Now, that is the right hemisphere at work. That is what's called gestalt perception, which comes at an aha moment when you suddenly see it. You don't build it up from little bits. You have to see the whole thing. And there is actually no way that the brain could say, well, that's obviously a bit of a path. That's obviously a bit of a dog or something. You know, it just can't be done. So there's no way you can get one little certitude and add another little certitude and build your wall in the way that the left hemisphere does. And most things in life are actually understood more in this way than they are in the other way. These are rather fun. How am I doing? Quarter of an hour? Yeah. These are, I'll just go quickly through these, but they are interesting and most people won't have seen these. These are done by inactivating one hemisphere or the other, which you can do temporarily by various means for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then getting people to draw things. So, quickly, on the left you've got flowers, and then you've got what the left hemisphere draws when it's asked to draw a flower, which, as you can see, is entirely schematic. It's a representation of a flower, but it's nothing like a flower. It's a symbol, in fact. Whereas on the right, you've got this rather exuberant thing from the right hemisphere. Here, this is just to show that depth is better shown by the right hemisphere than by the left, which tends to see things flatter. And these are all by the left hemisphere alone. So this is the left hemisphere on the left drawing a cube, then a table, then a tree. Look at some of those. A person, and then the flower again. So, okay. Yeah, we know all about those. Don't worry about that. For the moment, no. So, I just thought actually what would be very good would be just to read you a few passages, because you may think that this is all very abstract, and I'm just making this up, really. When I talk about the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, I'm really just talking about ideas. I'm really just talking about two ways of looking at the world. Well, I am talking about two ways of looking at the world, but I really am telling you about what's going on in your brain. And just to make it very vivid, I just want to read you some little clinical vignettes, okay? Now, after a right hemisphere stroke, this is a man describing his own body. Remember that now he's dependent. The left half of reality has gone pretty much AWOL because his right hemisphere is not working and making his body properly lived and embodied. So the bit that's left is going to be only what the left hemisphere can afford to give it, and this is what it gives it. Where the left half of his chest, abdomen, and stomach should be, he's got only a wooden plank. It goes right down to his anus and is divided into compartments by transverse planks. Food doesn't follow the usual path from the stomach through the intestines. It gets sucked into the compartments of this scaffolding and it falls through the hole at the bottom of the framework. All this is only on the left side. On the right, the organs are all perfectly in place. And another important thing to know about the left hemisphere is that it doesn't know what it doesn't know. There's been a very good article recently by a chap called Stanley Fish, who you may know, philosopher, who I think it was actually published in the New York Times, but it was entitled something like, something Rumsfeldian, like, does the left hemisphere, no, not does the left hemisphere, does reason know what reason doesn't know? If you see what I mean. Is it aware of what it can't be aware of? Because it's quite dangerous if you're not aware of your own limitations. And in fact, the left hemisphere is not aware at all of what it, as it were, is not equipped to understand. And so it sees the world as very simple and mechanical, and it makes sense in these terms. And no need to complicate it by all this interconnectedness and empathy and spiritual things and God knows what. So, but in quite practical terms, it will deny, it's totally unrealistic. If you ask people, if you inactivate people's right hemisphere and just ask their left hemisphere to do a self-assessment on a personality score, they will do what we call polishing. They will give themselves a very good mark on just about everything compared with what other people would say about them. But if you ask their right hemisphere to do the same task, it tends to be much more realistic and much more in tune with what other people would say about them. So here's a good example of being out of touch with the realities that might be quite severely unfortunate. This is somebody who's had a right hemisphere stroke and has a left paralyzed arm. And there is a process whereby you can inhibit the left hemisphere briefly and allow the right hemisphere to sort of stand forth a little bit. It's called vestibular stimulation. It involves putting cold water into the auditory canal. So you don't need to worry about that detail, but I just want to read this conversation. So people deny when they've got this paralyzed limb that it's anything to do with them. You know, no, they come along, this person's had a stroke, half their body doesn't move. How are you? I'm fine, yes, yes. Could you move your left hand for me? Yes, yes. You didn't move it. Yes, I did, didn't you see it? It's really quite striking. Now, this is the conversation. Examiner, whose arm is this? Pointing to the patient's paralyzed arm. It's not mine. Whose is it? It's my mother's. How on earth does it happen to be here? I don't know. I found it in my bed. How long has it been there? Since the first day. Feel, it's warmer than mine. The other day, too, when the weather was colder, it was warmer than mine. So where is your left arm? Makes an indefinite gesture forward. It's under there. Immediately after vestibular stimulation, inhibiting the left hemisphere, the examiner asks the patient to show her the patient's left arm. The patient points to her own left arm. Here it is. Is this arm yours? Why? Yes. Where's your mother's arm? Somewhere about. Where exactly? I don't know. Perhaps here, under the bedclothes? 2 hours after vestibular stimulation, questioned again. Whose arm is this? It's my mother's. And so on. So I won't press that, but it goes on. But perhaps a more extraordinary, I mean, less really striking in that sort of obvious dramatic way, but ultimately most important is this really interesting thing that was done by Deglin and Kinsborn in Russia, where in the old days they used to be able to sort of give ECT to one or other hemisphere. Now, it's a treatment for depression. It's actually a very good treatment for depression and quite a civilized one these days because it's done with an anesthetic and a muscle relaxant. And there's nothing wrong with giving ECT, but I think probably we wouldn't do what was possible in Russia, which was to give it alternately to the left or the right hemisphere. We tend to give it to both, or to the used to give it to the right hemisphere because the right hemisphere doesn't do anything. But anyway, so in Russia they were able to do this. So and this results for 15 or 20 minutes in the hemisphere that's had ECT not really responding. Now just to try to take this in, it's about a syllogism, okay? Take the following example of a syllogism with a false premise. Syllogism is where you reason from premises to a conclusion. So, major premise, all monkeys climb trees. Minor premise, the porcupine is a monkey. Implied conclusion, the porcupine climbs trees. Well, does it? As Deglin and Kinsborne demonstrated, each hemisphere has its own way of approaching this question. At the outset of their experiment, when the intact individual is asked, does the porcupine climb trees? She replies, using, of course, both hemispheres, it doesn't climb, the porcupine runs on the ground, it's prickly, it's not a monkey. Now, actually, unfortunately, that happened to be porcupines that climb trees, but that obviously wasn't known to these people. Put that out of your mind, okay? For the purposes of this story, that they don't climb trees. During experimental temporary hemisphere inactivations, the left hemisphere of the very same individual, this is not a different person, this is the same person, okay? This is their left hemisphere talking now, replies that the conclusion is true. The porcupine climbs trees, since it is a monkey. When the experimenter asks, but is the porcupine a monkey? She replies that she knows it's not. When the syllogism is presented again, however, she's a little nonplussed, but replies in the affirmative, since that's what's written on the card. When the right hemisphere of the same individual, the very same person, but the left hemisphere inactivated, is asked if the syllogism is true, she replies, how can it climb trees? It's not a monkey. It's wrong here. Now, the point, and they go on to do lots, it's repeated with many other things, like, you know, sort of, all trees sink in water, balsa is a tree, balsa wood sinks in water, northern lights are often seen in Africa, Uganda's in Africa, northern lights are seen in Uganda. One of the premises is wrong, and you reach a conclusion which follows. And in every case, the left hemisphere prefers the internal logic of the situation. What is the theoretical construct here? What it says on this bit of paper. But it's the right hemisphere that understands actually what's going on in the real world. Now, that has enormous importance for what I'm just about to say, because I am going to wrap up now. So the second half of the book is all about what's going on in... never mind. What's going on throughout the process of Western civilization as it unfolds. And if you want to ask me about the different eras, I can do. But effectively what I find in a few sentences is a lot of evidence that both the hemispheres seem to be working really, really well at the beginning of the ancient Greek period in the 6th century BC, working together, complementing one another. But as time goes on, inevitably the left hemisphere seems to become more predominant. And things that used to be understood, like that things and their opposites could come together, become suddenly untrue. Theory gets more important than experience. Science becomes more theoretical and formal than it becomes empirical. And the arts begin to suffer, and tragedy, which had been so great, this necessary distance between ourselves and the other that I was talking about, in which we come to empathize with other human individuals, that deteriorated. And then the same thing happens in the Roman Empire. There's this period of the Augustan era in which, again, they work well together, and then things move on to a rather blockish, sort of left hemisphere kind of world. It's not just an accident, it has a sort of poetic truth, that the Roman Empire was made possible by the invention of concrete, and you get these massive formless structures, impressive by their hugeness. Whereas in the classical period, it's all about proportion and relation, and wonderful human faces that are expressive become stylized, simplified, and set in hierarchical structures which have meaning only to the mind, not to our senses and to our intuitions. So this process seems to go on in both of those civilizations. And it seems to me it's going on in our own. At the Renaissance, again, I haven't got time to go into all of this, it's a few hundred pages in my book, but the Renaissance and the Reformation, the Renaissance is the beginning of this working together of the two hemispheres. I think the Reformation is the beginning of the rise of the left hemisphere, and the Enlightenment very much more so, when things could only work if they were like pieces of data that could be inserted into other people, rather as you could input something into a computer. And all truths should be self-consistent and should be communicable easily to another person, rather than having to be evoked out of them. They can be posted into them, which of course doesn't work, and so on. So a new kind of reality in which we were just entities within a machine-like structure began to be the model of the world. In the old days, in the medieval period, and in the ancient world, the model, if you wanted to try and understand something, you compared it to a tree, you compared it to a river, you compared it to a family, you compared it to a body. Now we just compare everything, including the body, the tree, to a machine. And in our own century, it seems to me things have gone very, very badly wrong, and I'm just going to say a little bit about that. That's a nice image of the head being deserted from the body. In our own age, the things that would have led us to see that there's something wrong with this left hemisphere world have been undercut and ironized. The natural world in which most people used to live, 98% of the population, now you can live all your life in an urban environment where you never see the natural world really at all. Our culture has been disrupted by the movements of ourselves into cities, the disruption of ancient ways of doing things, and of traditions, so that we don't have inherited wisdom anymore. Everything is made explicit and has to be re-examined in an algorithmic sort of way. The body has become a sort of mechanism. A bit of sex has become a sort of lifestyle choice, or a bit like a game of tennis or something, rather than being the means whereby we can actually, for some not very spiritual people, can have some of their few experiences of the eternal and the ultimately beautiful. And art has been ironized into a set of concepts, and beauty seems to have been lost. Religion, what can I say about that in the modern era? So that's really just what I think's happened here, is that we've just got the representation on the windows, and behind apparently nothing, although you can see that on the right window there, the representation is actually becoming the reality, which I believe is where we are now. And I might have, do I have the world that we're in now? Yes, sorry about this. We don't have to look at all that. But really, what I see now is that we've lost the broader picture. The virtual has become more important than the real in all walks of life. We're less involved with skill and judgment, more in working out things in a rationalistic way. Knowledge has been replaced by information. Wisdom has been replaced by knowledge. And tokens or representations of things have become more important than the things themselves. Anybody in a profession will know that ticking the boxes and having the certificate and the bit of paper is more important than the experience. In the world I work in, the most valuable people on the wards are nurses who haven't a single qualification but have worked for years and years and years with people, and their wisdom and insight is wonderful, and I know that my patients are safe with them. And some of the people who come very fresh from courses where they really don't know much about life, but they've certainly ticked some boxes. Quite worrying in that respect. Bureaucracy has taken over. Procedures that are known have to be the way that things are done. We're all reduced to the same sort of, Procrustean way. We're all reduced to replications of one another. There's a loss of the sense of uniqueness. Things become black and white, either or. The notion that actually you have to fudge it and it's grey and it's bits of this and bits of that is not a popular one these days. Quantities have taken over from quality, a loss of cohesion. Paranoia, all these cameras around the place. Left hemisphere is very paranoid. That's why schizophrenics become paranoid, because they're thinking only about themselves. So they think everything in the world refers to them. And actually, if you're a government, you think everybody's out to get you. And you start needing to control everybody, because in fact, social trust is a right hemisphere mediated phenomenon. And so on. You can look at those, really. But I just see things breaking up and moving into this left hemisphere world. And all the exits, in a way, being blocked off by the left hemisphere. The reason the left hemisphere comes ultimately to control, you may ask, why does it always shift relentlessly to the left? And I think there are two or three reasons, and that's the last thing I'm going to say, promise. Number one, it controls the media. And I call it the Berlusconi of the brain, you know, because it's the one that actually has the control of what it is we say and how we construct the argument. So it's always going to be money for old rope for it to argue its case, but it's really difficult for those of us who believe in the realities of what our right hemispheres tell us to argue for that, because we haven't got the words for it and we haven't got the structures for it. And that's one of the reasons. Another is that its world is very, very simple. It's child's play to see everything as mechanical. And after that, you don't need to get into all the complications. So you can just account for it in that way. And that, of course, is a sort of reality. And it's a kind of reality that needs very carefully to be shifted back into the right hemisphere's realm and the good that comes out of it used. But unfortunately, we've got stuck in it. I do have a few rays of hope, which are that we can learn from the Orient. I say a bit about that at the end of the book. If people want to ask me about that, I will talk about that. It might be interesting in this particular community here. There is neuropsychological data that people in the Far East see things differently from the way we do, in ways that much more helpfully balance the hemispheres. It's not that the East is right hemisphere and we are left hemisphere. It's just that the East is very balanced in the way it uses the two hemispheres, whereas we've gone overboard to the left. Right, I'm going to stop there, and then I would be very happy to answer questions if you have any. Perhaps we can put this off.
Two roving microphones. Please have your way with Ian.
What an invitation.
Is this on?
Yes.
So how in history did you get a switch back so that there was a balance again between the hemispheres and get the start of a new Renaissance?
Yes, a lovely question. Unfortunately, history is a little bleak on this one because it took 1,000 years between the ancient world and the Renaissance. And we haven't got 1,000 years. I think there is a natural move within any one period between the right and the left, because an excess of right hemisphere ways of thinking leaves something else as well, and we feel the need to go to look at things in another way. And I think that when things become too left hemisphere centred, some people at any rate, probably a lot of people in this room, begin to see the necessity of moving away from that. But at the moment, I don't know whether we will succeed. We haven't got very long. And
tragic situation.
It does. I mean, I talk about us somnambulistically shuffling towards the abyss, really, whistling a happy tune, because the left hemisphere is like, what problem? No problem here, we've got it all under control, and so on. But one thing we might be able to do is to learn from Oriental ways of being before the Orient becomes so occidentalized that they've lost it themselves, because they're in the process of throwing away their own traditions and taking on ours, very sadly. But there is some also hope in that, you know, I just believe in human beings. And there are lots of points in history where it must have looked very bleak. And within a decade or two, people have started thinking in a very radically different way. And you wouldn't have foreseen it if you'd been there at the time. But you might have just been in the Dark Ages, the beginning of them.
Could I just think out loud that when you've been talking, I've been reminded of the importance of balance in our lives and non-interference with natural functions.
Yep.
Would you be able to comment on that, please?
Well, balance is surely very important, and it was one of the great things that both the classical Greek period and the Renaissance thought most important was harmony. And I have a lot to say about the difference between the sort of view in which there's a coincidentia oppositorum, a coincidence of opposites, a bringing together of the opposites in the philosophy, and those in which they're polarized as the opposite ends of things that can't be made to cohere. And I suppose that we've moved further and further into a black and white either-or kind of way of thinking, which is unhelpful, and that harmonizing and balancing would be important. When you say a recurrence to the natural, I know exactly what you mean, and I would largely, of course, support the intuition behind what you say. But, of course, human beings are themselves not natural, and I mean, we are natural, but we've also done a lot of rather amazing things to the world, which are perhaps not so natural, and so we wouldn't want to jettison the benefits of civilization. And so there's always this argument about what we need to do. But those are my thoughts. Although Alan Watts said that thoughts grow in minds as naturally as grass grows in fields, which is probably a good way of putting it.
If the brain is naturally structured so that over time the left brain becomes dominant, why would that be if it isn't in our best interests?
Well, I don't think it is naturally structured so that it does become dominant. I think in the West it has done, because we have probably, for reasons that I can only speculate about, and they may have to do with the nature of language. I've been corresponding with a Chinese professor in Denmark who is very interested in brain differences in the Orient and the West. And his idea is that language, being a different kind of thing in the Orient, has enabled the hemispheres not to close down in this way that they have in the West. I'm not so sure about that. In the book, I do talk about the origins of language and the change in direction of writing and so forth that went on during the ancient Greek period and what that means. And some people have seen that as the root of the change in the way we see the world. And some people have also seen the invention of money, which of course is other tokens for things that came about in that same period, as being the driver towards a new kind of cognition in the West. But I don't think so. I think they're more, not so much causes as results, if you like, the effects of a change in the brain that happened for other reasons. And one can speculate about what those might have been. But I don't think it has to be that way. I just think that the way that we have got into with our language and our thinking means that we do close things down very quickly into this, what I call, hall of mirrors, a self-reflexive world, which is the world that postmodernism, in a way, both laments and celebrates. You know, well, there isn't really anything. It's just made up out of our own words and out of our own thoughts. But that's just the left hemisphere talking. It doesn't have knowledge of the reality beyond language. And I don't think this seems to have happened in the Orient at all. So it's something peculiar that's happened to human beings in the West, I would say.
That we could have gone down another route without language?
Well, I mean, that's highly speculative, because, I mean, human beings without language would be interesting. But I mean, the third chapter of my book is called Language, Truth and Music, a kind of kick in the nuts to Fred Ayer's Language, Truth and Logic. But really what I'm saying is, in that, is that people say language is important for... why do we have language? Obviously to communicate. Well, that's not true. First of all, animals that don't have language communicate. Children, pre-linguistic children, communicate their needs pretty effectively. We can communicate about things even if we don't have language. It's also true that it's not for thinking, because we can think. It used to be said you can't think of something, you have a word for it. That is utter rubbish. You can look at some Amazonian tribes that only count 1, 2, 3, but they can actually do calculations as well as a French-speaking person who's got all the words. So that can't be right either. And, you know, people who've had a stroke, lost speech, they think perfectly well, and so on. And children that can't speak about things, they're definitely thinking about things. So you know, we don't really need it for any of those things. We only need language to pin things down in a certain way. We need it for empire. And I think in the West it became a tool of empire. The first things that were language was used for, the first written things that we have are all about bureaucratic regulation of, you know, how many bushels of corn there are in the granary and that sort of thing, and taxes and armies, and basically extending your control. Because what language allows you to do, you can do most things with between two people. You can communicate very well without words. You know, try communicating with a loved one over the telephone, or try communicating with a patient doing therapy over the telephone. You've got to have them there, I think. And so it works on the I you or I thou sort of level, but on the I it level, you need language to refer to things that aren't here. And that's when you start getting, you know, empire building and manipulating. Then you need language as we know language.
I assume that you're familiar with Deleuze and Guattari's work on capitalism and schizophrenia, and their thesis that with the rise of capitalism, we've moved towards a sort of more schizophrenic way of being. And I wondered what you thought about capitalism in that sense, and whether it's a sort of, whether it's linked with your thesis of the rise of left-sided way of thinking.
Very good question, thank you. The answer is, I think it is connected. One of the intriguing things is that there are very good descriptions of what used to be called manic depression, now we call it bipolar disorder, in ancient Greece, in Egypt, and so on. There are no descriptions of schizophrenia. There are no descriptions at all of it until the 18th century, although there are plenty of depression and mania and dementia even and so forth, Parkinson's disease, but not that. And it has been speculated that in fact it arose in the 18th century. Now, when you put that together with the fact that it seems to have risen very sharply pari passu with industrialization, and that as countries industrialized, the number of people with schizophrenia rocketed. And this is true not just in this country, but in America and in other parts of Europe, in Italy, in Ireland, in Russia, and so forth. So it's a replicable finding. And when you put that again together with the fact that the rates of schizophrenia seem higher among urban dwellers, it may have something to do with the pressures of the kind of lives we lead in modern cities. And so, and as that's largely the product of capitalism and its competitive and atomistic way of setting individual against individual, and the breaking up of the sort of empathic structures in which people were related, I would see that, yes, it's quite possibly a relevant observation. I've actually, in the last chapter of the book, I also talk about the rise in autism and Asperger's syndrome, as well as anorexia nervosa, which may be related to it, to both those conditions. Subtly, in the 20th century, and they both, all those conditions, autism, Asperger's syndrome, and particularly dramatically anorexia nervosa, appear like failures of the right hemisphere. It's quite interesting. And they've all become commoner in our era, when I say the left hemisphere is dominating. Yeah.
Is this working? Yep, okay. From the little that I know about the brain structure, I know that there's a symmetry in the brain.
Yep.
For example, in the sensory cortex, the motor cortex, how those parts of the brain...
Did you say symmetry?
Symmetry, well...
Did you say asymmetry?
Symmetry.
Yeah, symmetry.
In that, you know, the motor cortex on the left...
Sure, the motor cortex
will control,
sensory cortex is symmetrical.
Yeah, so those will control the different parts of the body. Can you say something about how that symmetry might relate to the vast sort of differences that you're talking about? Because that when I read basic textbooks on the brain, I'm struck by this sort of quite simplistic symmetry, but I can't relate it to these other general aspects.
Yes. Well, our bodies are symmetrical largely, not entirely. But grossly they are, and so there's as much need on one side as the other to control and receive sensory information from those parts of the body, and those bits are going to be symmetrical. But I suppose what I'm talking about is that it is not symmetrical really in any other important respect in terms of the sort of world that the brain helps bring about for us. Obviously, we have to move symmetrically about in space, so those motor and sensory strips are largely symmetrical. But the rest is.
Do you think that the differences that you're talking about wouldn't necessarily manifest themselves in differences between the two sides of the body in terms of the way we might move or something like that?
Well, I mean, there is this difference in humans in handedness, I suppose, is the first thing to say, isn't it? That for most of us, we're asymmetrically handed. So that's clearly an interaction with the environment, which is asymmetrical. People tend more to put, to be able to distinguish auditory input better with their right ear going to their left auditory cortex, and so on. So there are these very fine distinctions that can be made on experimental research, but then they fall in very much with you know what we know about the brain and what I've tried to talk about. Was there something special you had in mind there?
No, not really. I'm just trying to reconcile the fact that there does seem to be symmetry with these two very very different views on the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm a Alexander Technique specialist, right. So I'm sort of interested in that side of things and in the body.
Yeah.
Very much. And it, without having been able to go into great depth, it's in my case, it's I'm just struck by the sort of the difference between the symmetry and the difference that you're talking about.
Well, I suppose the thing is that there's both symmetry and asymmetry, and it's not either or, it's both. And it's broadly speaking, the brain is symmetrical, but when you come to look at it, even structurally it's not, and certainly functionally it's not. But one's always up against this thing that, you know, the two hemispheres are more similar than they are different, but the differences are very significant. Overall, they make huge difference to how we see the world. And if you're comparing two cars, you know, they have more things in common than they have not in common, but the things that distinguish them are the whole things that make us select one more than the other. So it's about difference in sameness and sameness in difference, which is a very, very important concept. Union within division within union. It ends up with having to be unified, but it's the union of division and union that is unified. A bit Hegelian there.
In the experiment in which one of the hemispheres is inactivated experimentally,
yeah.
What happens to the subject's sense of self?
Well, of course, the sense of self is a very hard thing to get precise about in a short time window. But I didn't deal with the concept of the self, which is, most of what we know about that is not really based so much on those experiments, because they are so short-lived. I mean, largely you're talking about minutes. But they're more to do with neuroimaging, where you give people different tasks to do, and you can see how which sort of concepts of you can disentangle by carefully constructing your experiment, how they see themselves, and also from injuries and lesions to bits of the brain, what goes missing in the sense of the self. And I suppose both the sense of the self is dependent on both hemispheres. What we know is that probably the earliest and most important development of the sense of the self comes about in the right ventromedial frontal cortex through the empathic engagement of the mother's face with the child's face. And Alan Shaw, who some people will know the work of, has written very interestingly about all of this. And so initially I would say that the sense of the self as a connected person that is, you know, division within union is separate but not completely separate from the mother, but that has a growing core of sense of self, that is mediated from the right ventromedial frontal cortex, which is the bit that is also responsible for empathy and is the bit that seems not to be working very well in psychopaths. Now, then there is the left hemisphere, which seems to be more to do with conscious will and control. So, you know, being able to, I'm the person who's controlling this and willing that and the other. But the right hemisphere also, it's a very complicated area, and it's the least easy one to rehash quickly. But I do talk about it in the book. But the right hemisphere does have its own sort of, not exactly will, but more desires, or things to which it's attracted, it seems to me. I talk about the difference between a desire for something and an attraction towards it. But perhaps we don't need to go into all of that. But anyway, there is a difference in the sense of, both are important to the sense of self. Each hemisphere can sustain a sense of self on its own, clearly. But over a long, long period, you'd find that the sort of self and the sort of attitudes, opinions, behaviour of that self differed. And yes, very interestingly, you would think, wouldn't you, that having a left hemisphere stroke was more disabling than having a right hemisphere stroke for most people. Because for 89% of us, the left hemisphere, if you have a major stroke in it, you can't speak and you can't move your right hand, your most important tool. But in fact, it's people with right hemisphere strokes who do least well in the long run in terms of rehab, because they don't have any insight into what it is they can't do. They think they can do things they can't do. They have no awareness of that. They don't empathize very well with other people. They misunderstand social signals. They become rather atomistic. Whereas the person who is left hemisphere impaired, although they can't speak very clearly, or they can learn to, but it's more difficult, and they can't use their right hand, they're actually intact as a human being in contact with the world and other people much better.
You ended your talk saying you would speak a bit more about the Eastern mind, or
yeah,
way of...
Yeah.
I just wondered whether you would.
Yes, sure. There are some experiments I could talk about, but I mean, effectively, overall, over the last 20 years, there's been quite a lot of research done on Far Easterners. This is not so much members of the Indian subcontinent, but it is more Koreans, Japanese, and Chinese. And it does seem that they approach... if you ask them to attend to a scene and remember things, they will remember more of what of the whole of it and the context of it, and figures that are sort of background aspects of it as well as foreground, whereas a Westerner will seize on one or two elements that are striking, and those are the things that are in the picture. So, for example, shown a picture of an aquarium, a Westerner will tend to say, well, there were two big fish in the front and I'm not sure what else there was, whereas the Oriental person will be able to say more about what there was going on in this tank as well as the fish that were in the front. So there's that. Also, if asked about to do things like sort of understanding of solving certain problems, Westerners will use only left hemisphere techniques. Oriental people will be more at ease using more gestalt techniques for getting there. They tend to be more consensual, and they prefer things that are ambivalent, whereas Westerners get more and more frustrated with things that are not clear. And so, for example, there's a Chinese proverb, too humble is half proud. And Americans go sort of, what? That's nonsense. That's very, very cruel. They don't. But they don't like that. They prefer half a loaf is better than no bread, because it's sequential, it's logical, it's ordered, whereas the other thing invites you to turn everything upside down. And, you know, the things that if you ask me what really strikes me, it's about things that I discovered about the Japanese language, which, you know, I'm not a Japanese speaker. But there is a word which I can't now remember, maybe somebody here knows it, but it is the word which is the normal word in Japanese if you're writing up a scientific experiment, that we use the word observe. You know, I observe, da 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 da. And this meaning, I mean, there's a lot in the book about different words for seeing, because it's not just a kind of passive process, it's an interactive process. And in classical Greek, there are about 9 words for seeing, depending on the mood and the relationship and things coming from the eye and so on. So it wasn't this passive camera thing at all. Anyway, the word, to get back to the point, the word that the Japanese use in this situation is a word that translates roughly into English as gazed at, which is a word we only use for when we're in rapt adoration of something and completely awestruck by it. So that struck me as very interesting. And, you know, there are other things anyway in the language. One left-right thing that's quite interesting is that in most cultures, right is superior, stronger, healthy, good, left is weak, you know, and all the rest. But actually in Chinese, the right is practically superior, but the left is spiritually superior. And indeed, even in battle, they were encouraged to shoot at the soldier's left eye, in fact, which struck me as interesting. But they think the left eye and the left hand are superior, in fact, to the right. And there's a chap called James Hall who wrote a book called The Sinister Side about the way in which we've changed our views about these things over time. And what really struck me is that although broadly speaking it's the way I said, you know, that the right is good, left is bad, at the times when I think the right hemisphere came to the fore, in the classical world, in the Renaissance, and again in Romanticism, left suddenly becomes more important again. More special, more communicative, more rich, more spiritual.
Ian, I'm not a member, a regular member of this group, but what I sense is that what often brings members of this group together is some concern for, in the broad sense, meditation or the sort of things that go with that. Now, obviously, that's taken many forms in different times and different cultures, but I was just wondering whether the language of the hemispheres had any significant insights to bear on meditation.
Thank you. I learned a bit about this since, because a lot of people who meditate, and indeed some sort of oriental sort of spiritual figures have written to me about it, and apparently, I didn't know this, there is literature that suggests that the EEG becomes more balanced between the hemispheres during meditation, and that the normal left hemisphere preponderance seems to... it's not a total preponderance, of course, it's a partial preponderance, but it seems to equalize during meditation. But people talk about spirituality in the brain as though there should be a God spot and so forth. Well, I totally reject that, because in fact everything important is going on in the brain all over. And as I said, each hemisphere has its input to everything. It has its own input to every single thing that's human. So it's going to have its own input, just as the right hemisphere does, to the divine. And the particular thing that the left hemisphere is good at is simplification and focus. And it may be interesting to some people that, in fact, what seems to happen during blissful states achieved by skillful meditators is that there seems to be a lot of overdrive in the left frontal lobe, which is quite interesting. One way of thinking about that is that the frontal lobe inhibits the posterior cortex, and it inhibits more profoundly the posterior cortex of its own hemisphere. So it may be, this is slightly Jesuitical thinking perhaps, but it may be that in fact the left frontal lobe is active in stilling all that linguistic categorical thinking going on in the posterior part of the same hemisphere. Or it may just be that that is another aspect of the divine. The other area that's always comes up in these studies, at least in imaging studies, is the right temporoparietal region. So it's the right posterior and left frontal seem to be significant.
This is about an experience rather than history or theory. As an architect, some years ago, I was... had to design something for St. Christopher's Hospice. It had to fit between two existing buildings, one of which was big and one of which was small, and at funny angles to each other. I attended a whole lot of meetings. They didn't tell me what they wanted. They tell me, in the end, they found out what functions they wanted to be fitted into this building. So then it's what follows that's the relevant thing, which was that I sat down at my drawing board, no computers then, and worked for about 2 weeks. And as you said about something, if I did this, then that would happen. That's no good. Let's try the other, and then this will happen. And that, to me, is left hemisphere work for about 2 weeks. And then suddenly, like a shaft of light, I know the whole of it. All I've got to do now is draw it. It's as if somebody else was working away in there.
As well.
yes. And it's like Mozart said.
Yes.
It came complete, but it needed its details filled in.
Exactly.
As if it came from somewhere else.
Exactly. That's a wonderful observation. Thank you. And the thing that comes to my mind is a passage in the Prelude by Wordsworth. I think it's the opening of book 12. Where I can't remember the exact words, but basically his drift is that you don't achieve things by this striving towards them in that logical way, but you have to do that first. And if you don't do that, it won't happen. You then do that, knowing it won't be producing the result, and when you're looking away, the thing comes to you. And there are many accounts, and some of them are in this book, of mathematicians who did things like this, and Einstein was one, and the chemist Kekulé, you remember, saw the structure of the benzene ring when he was gazing into the fires, trying to work it out. He fell asleep, and he saw these serpents eating their tails, doing the hexagon of the benzene ring. And then there's this wonderful thing by Poincaré, where he was struggling to solve some Fuchsian equation. I don't know what they are. I don't know what the Fuchsian they are, but he was trying to do that, and he spent a long, long time, but he spent 2 weeks, he drank lots of coffee, and he was up all night, and he was working away, and he gave up, and he went off into the local town, and on the way back, he says, at the moment I put my foot on the platform of the bus, it all suddenly became clear to me, and I just went home and wrote it down. It's amazing.
I just wondered whether there was much evidence for... you know, in the nature of, say, genius in terms of the hemispheres, or, you know, is it a balance, great creative power? Is it a balance in the hemispheres, or is it an extreme of one or the other? I just was...
Another marvellous question. Two things. Creativity depends on both hemispheres, not, as the hippie thing would tell you, just the right hemisphere. And one of the very few things that happened to the split brain patients, these patients who had callosotomy, the corpus callosum severed in the 1960s and 70s, in the earliest operations by people like Roger Sperry that Martin referred to, that was an operation which was done to relieve intractable epilepsy, to stop it spreading from one half of the brain to the other, so that at least they could maintain consciousness. And this revolutionized the lives of these patients. But the striking thing was they were pretty much normal in everyday life. You think, my God, they've got their brains cut in half, what are they going to be like? But largely, our brain's hemispheres function separately anyway, and by now they've been trained to do so. And if you went on holiday with them, never mind had dinner with them, you probably wouldn't know anything much was different. But the two things that seemed to be diminished, one was dreaming and the other was creativity. That's one answer. The other answer really is to say genius is more likely to be related, I think, to right hemisphere functioning. We've just talked about practically all these great artists and great musicians and great composers and so on needing to be able to step outside. And the aha moment, actually you can see it in the right superior temporal gyrus, when the thing goes, that intuition that is right temporal. Related to that, in children, those who have better right hemisphere function tend to be the more intelligent ones, and it may also be true in adults, but we do need both. Yeah.
Hello there. You mentioned it there, and I wanted to pick up a little bit on this around dreaming.
Right.
I don't know, there's obviously, I think politicians have used the phrase that they go to bed with bits of the puzzle and wake up with the answer. And
yes.
I've certainly experienced something where I'm dropping off and for the first time I think I've got the perfect answer, if only I can wake up and sort of write it down.
Yes.
And I just wonder if you'd say something about what happens to the hemispheres during sleep and dreaming.
Well, you know the story of Swinburne dropping asleep and suddenly realizing the meaning of the universe, and he jotted it down on a bit of paper and went to sleep, and when he woke up in the morning it said, what is it, Higgamus Hogamus, woman's monogamous, Hogamus Higgamus, man is polygamous. But anyway, so it's not always good news when the moment of inspiration comes. But I think that, yeah, dreaming is really important. Letting go of our conscious pursuit of something is very important. This is the tip of the tongue phenomenon, isn't it? The harder you try, the less you remember it, then you go away and it comes to you. And that's because, interestingly, at the brain level, the left and right hemisphere, I didn't go into the neuroarchitecture, but they are somewhat differently constructed. And the left hemisphere, which is constantly trying to focus on a target, actually narrows down. The more you focus, the harder you try. It narrows its recruitment of neurons and intensifies them in the place. So it's that whole thing about looking more and more in the place under the spotlight instead of thinking, well, it might be outside the spotlight. The right hemisphere, it has more white matter which interconnects distant regions. It's better able to make remote connections and understand how things relate to one another. So on the one hand, you need this conscious effort to understand the structure and the relationship, as you have to understand your building at the concrete level. But then you also have to be able to switch that off to allow the rest of the mind to work with what that's given it. That is a perfect example of what I was trying to say about right, left, right. The right has the idea. The left goes away and works on it. And finally, it's integrated into a whole by the right. Now, dreaming, we don't know much about this. I differ from John Cussing, which is a dangerous thing to do, because he's a very clever man. But he thinks that dreaming is largely left hemisphere. I don't. I think it's more right hemisphere. And as far as I'm concerned, most of the evidence is on my side. So that most of the studies that we've done show increased cerebral blood flow in the right hemisphere and increase in the EEG during rapid eye movement sleep, which is the dreaming part of sleep, in the right hemisphere. Sorry, did that answer your question? Okay.
Last question.
I was going to simply say, isn't it wonderful that we have both the right and the left hemisphere? We don't need in any way to put value judgments on, because each does what it does best.
I agree.
And they come together as a kind of blessed unity.
I like that and agree with it.
One post-penultimate question.
I just wanted to ask about with the right brain within schizophrenics and not working so effectively, has this understanding changed the way that we're able to treat people? And also wanted to ask you to comment on the impact of trauma, not necessarily stroke trauma that you were talking about, but other physical or emotional trauma on that part of the brain.
Right. The first thing to say is that when I say that schizophrenics are like people whose right hemisphere isn't functioning, they're not just like an isolated left hemisphere. Their right hemisphere is not working very well. Their left hemisphere is also not working normally. It's working in overdrive in a certain sort of way. And probably also, just to complicate things, some of the things that are normally done in the left hemisphere are going on in the right and vice versa. In other words, the boundaries between the hemispheres have broken down. The important distinction between the master and the emissary is not working. The master's trying to do emissary work, the emissary's trying to do the master's work, neither of them doing them terribly well, and you get some rather bizarre results. So it's not a simple left-right equation. And it doesn't help, no. But I have wanted to ask Janet Treasurer at the Maudsley if she would, I haven't plucked up my courage to ask her yet, whether she would be willing to try transcranial magnetic stimulation to the right hemispheres of people with anorexia, because the evidence is just so strong. She's done her own study on that, which has shown that where there are brain lesions, the vast majority of them are in the right hemisphere. When you do neuropsychological profile testing, anorexics tend to do everything left hemisphere. They're very obsessional, they're very rigid, they're very rule-bound. Their body image, which is observed almost exclusively by the right hemisphere, has gone AWOL, and they can't tell what's big, what's small, what fits where. Their emotional rapport, empathy, has gone. It's just a right hemisphere shutdown. And there's a marvelous case of a woman who had a stroke. She was disabled by anorexia, and she had a left thalamic stroke, and it disabled her left hemisphere. And the anorexia went away. I mean, like the next day, she was like, oh, I don't care about that at all. What was that? And she started to eat normally for the rest of her life. And the whole sort of body image thing disappeared. Quite extraordinary. Because by sort of having shut off the left hemisphere, it allowed the right hemisphere to... Because there's always this balance going on. If you disable one, you promote the other, and so forth. So it might have some consequences clinically, but I this is all a bit too speculative, really, for that. Can I just say something about wonder? Because I just did my last sentence. You asked me about how wonderful it all is, and I think it is very wonderful, about the brain. But I just read something. I'm reviewing James Lefanu's book Why Us, and in it I learned, which I didn't know, that the fetal human brain puts forth 25,000 new neurons per minute for 9 months, and they've all got to go in the right place, and they've all got to be connected correctly, and that's all supposed to be specified in a genetic code that is hardly any different from the fly. And it's really mind-boggling how that happens. I'm sure there must be a way. I don't believe in a God of the gaps, but it's pretty puzzling and very, very wonderful.
We couldn't create a machine that could self-wire 25, create them, wire them, 25,000 every minute for 9 months. I mean, anyway, thank you. Thank you very much.
Just before I give you a chance to applaud again, I'd like to thank Ian on your behalf very much indeed. I feel completely incompetent to make any comments about what he said, except this, that I feel enormously reassured that the things he's told us tonight resonate so strongly with the teachings that we follow in this house. And so on your behalf, thank you very much indeed, Ian.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.